Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, when vitamins may do more harm than good. But first, staying with health, Massachusetts is embarking on what many experts say is another revolution, this time in health care, and it's being watched closely across the country. Governor Mitt Romney, a possible Republican presidential candidate, is poised to sign a bill that would make Massachusetts the first state in the nation to require that all uninsured adults in the state purchase some kind of health insurance by July 2007 or be fined. The bill is unusual because it asks virtually everyone, government, businesses, and individuals, to help pay the cost of covering the uninsured. The state stood to lose $385 million in federal dollars if it didn't take steps to cover the uninsured. Joining us in the studio is Here Now reporter Martha Biebinger. And Martha, first of all, can you explain the overview? How is this plan supposed to work?
Well, Robin, as you just said, there are many parties to bringing coverage to all of the uninsured in Massachusetts. The first and probably most significant, first time in the nation this has ever happened, if it does in fact happen, is this requirement that all individuals will have to have health insurance. The state will assist with some subsidies for people who are in the lower income ranges. People earning, say, $48,000 a year for a family of three will get some assistance in buying those products. And businesses who don't offer insurance at all will start paying a fee to help fund those subsidies. The third component, besides the individuals and the employers, as you said, is the government. And the government will increase the threshold for Medicaid. Medicaid is the government-funded health care program. And more children in Massachusetts will now be eligible for that, as well as some single adults.
Well, this is pretty astonishing. I mean, you're saying that people, if this law passes, who don't buy insurance, who can afford it, might be fined. How much would the fine be?
The fine will be a tax penalty. The way the government will track who does have and doesn't have health insurance is through your tax returns. There will be these massive new databases that calculate who has what and whether the employer is contributing as well. If it's found that you don't have health insurance, and the way they would find that is when you go to get free care and it turns out, you're supposed to have it and you don't, then you could be fined part of your tax return that year if you're eligible for one, or there could be a penalty that would be the equivalent of half the cost of a health insurance plan. Mm-hmm. So let's say a health insurance plan costs maybe $2,400 a year for an individual. If the state is able to rein in the costs, then that's a $1,200 fine.
So you could be fined, but on the other hand, there are incentives for you to buy the insurance. You can buy insurance pre-taxes.
That's right. That's an option that is available right now to many of us who work for larger firms. But for individuals, it is not currently available. And that can shave as much as 25% to 30% off the cost of a health insurance plan.
If you buy the insurance, before your money's been taxed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what incentives are there for businesses to offer insurance to their uninsured employees? We understand there's a $295 fee for every employee every year that they don't insure. But we understand that this just applies to people who don't insure their employees already.
That's right. So it doesn't really become an incentive for them to offer insurance, because $295 is certainly cheaper than what they would pay to insure that employee.
That was going to be our question. I mean, it doesn't motivate them to insure their employee.
There's no appearance that it would motivate them. There's no appearance that it would motivate them to drop insurance necessarily either, though, because the reason that employers offer insurance is because they want higher quality employees. They want to give them that benefit.
Right. So if they don't have that demand from their employees, this is probably going to change their minds, but it will put money into a pot.
It does increase the money available to offer subsidies to people who may not be able to afford insurance.
Okay. What kind of affordable health insurance can a person who's uninsured buy?
That's a big question. And many of the health plans here in Massachusetts are scrambling with that right now. In the talks about developing this legislation, the item that seems to make health insurance cheaper is higher deductibles. In other words, the more you and I pay out of pocket, the cheaper the health care premium is. So the plans may not look all that different in terms of benefits, but they may eventually cost the individual who has to buy them a lot more out of pocket.
Right. But more people will be insured, and down the road, that lowers health care costs.
That's the hope.
The thinking is, how might this new Massachusetts plan, again, which has not yet been signed into law, but how might even just the thinking about it affect the national debate on health care?
The idea that individuals are responsible for their health insurance instead of the employers is a very radical shift. It's not been done elsewhere, and it is part of this larger thinking in many Republican circles about the ownership society, about making individuals both responsible, accountable, and really in charge of their finances. There is also the thinking, though, that if you shift to individual responsibility, you will be putting people in these larger buying pools, like this buying pool that the state of Massachusetts is going to create, that starts to look like a government health plan and may lead eventually to a large single payer, the sort of universal health care plan that many of the more liberal thinkers in the country like.
Yeah, we understand that many health care activists working for health care for everyone are tentatively saying this is potentially a good start.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of unknowns. So people like a lot of what they see, and they're very cautious about what they see as well.
Here now is Martha Biebinger reporting on a soon-to-be new law that would make Massachusetts the first state in the nation to require all residents to have health insurance. And as we said, it's being watched across the country. So tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll look more closely at some of the questions about the cost of the new law and its implications for health care. But while we're on the subject of health today, here's a question for you. Do you take vitamins? Most Americans do. Statistics show that more than 70% of households regularly buy vitamin supplements. Last year, Americans spent more than $7 billion on vitamins in the hopes of staying or getting healthy. But while Americans' appetite for vitamins continues unabated, new studies are claiming to show that vitamins not only don't work, but in some cases, they actually do harm. Tara Parker-Pope is the health columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She wrote on the science of vitamins, and she joins us now from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to spend some time on the subject. Welcome, Tara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we should say right at the outset that there's also criticism of these studies, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But let's start with the basics. What exactly is a vitamin?
Well, a vitamin is something that your body absolutely has to have. It's an essential nutrient, and for the most part, we get these vitamins from foods. And I think that we've seen that even though we have recommendations for vitamin supplements, taking these micronutrients in pill form, that overall we don't have vitamin deficiency disease in this country. So people are pretty healthy, and they're getting pretty much what they need from foods. So a vitamin is something we get from food and that we need from food, and it's also a supplement, something we can take in pill form.
And explain how they're supposed to work. As you write, they sort of mop up free radicals. What are those?
Well, free radicals are the compounds that are largely responsible for the disease process. They do a lot of the damage in our bodies that leads to heart disease and cancer. We don't entirely understand the role of vitamins. I think the reason people like to take vitamins is there is a general belief that these antioxidant vitamins will mop up the free radicals and stop that disease process, stop the damage from being done.
Because we should say free radicals come when cells are damaged by sunlight and by food and by aging, and you know, they naturally create these damaging free radicals.
Everybody has free radicals, you know, in their body. It's part of just the process of life. You know, cells die, they reproduce, they get damaged, and it's a very complex process. And so the question here is that are these free radicals serving another purpose? Are they there to also send a signal to the immune system to alert the immune system that the immune system needs to wake up and take action? And so I think one concern here is that when we are taking large doses of vitamins, are we interfering with this important process? Are we basically cleaning up the mess before the immune system even knows there is a mess? And are we stopping, the immune system is perhaps not being harnessed to come in and repair the damage and thwart disease? So that's the question. Is that what's happening when we're taking a lot of vitamins? And we don't really know the answer.
That's one of the big questions. But as you write, there are others. And you do a great job of going through a list of common vitamins and recent studies testing their effectiveness. So let's do that now. And again, I hasten to say there's also criticism of this thinking, and we are going to get to that. Let's start with vitamin A. What were the concerns?
We have several examples, really frightening examples, of some early studies using beta-carotene. The thinking was that beta-carotene would be very beneficial for people in terms of preventing lung cancer. And so they studied the use of beta-carotene in smokers and former smokers and in some workers who had been exposed to asbestos. And again, they went in believing that this would be beneficial. But what they found is that the people who took beta carotene actually had a higher incidence of lung cancer. In a study in 1994 in Finland, the beta carotene users showed an 18% higher incidence of lung cancer. This really changed the thinking, and suddenly people thought, well, gosh, we thought these substances were benign, and here we have a higher cancer rate.
Now, let me stop you right there, Tara. Could it be that, for instance, in that study, the people that were being studied already had a propensity for lung damage?
Absolutely, and this is what is so concerning about vitamins, because a healthy body perhaps responds one way to vitamin use and an unhealthy body a different way. And it may be that when you already have the disease process in place, that these antioxidants not only are not giving the benefit, but they might be somehow interfering with the immune system and leading to harm. And the concern is that a lot of people who become ill start taking handfuls of vitamins in hopes of boosting their immune system. And some of this data suggests that, sickness may not be the time to take vitamins.
Let's stick with vitamin A. There was a Harvard study of nurses. What did that show?
This was a very interesting study and really surprising to me. 72,000 nurses were just monitored for their basic health habits. And an important trend emerged. They found that the nurses who consumed high levels of vitamin A from foods, from multivitamins, from supplements, had a 48% higher risk for hip fracture than nurses who had the lowest intake of vitamin A. This trend was also apparent for women who only took vitamin A from foods, because foods are heavily fortified with vitamin A. So again, it's an example where we have healthy women who were getting a higher probably than a healthy dose of a vitamin and suffering a significant health problem, hip fracture, which is a devastating health problem.
We want to reinforce what you just said. So many foods now, cereals in particular, are fortified with vitamins. And so people may not know that they're getting too high a dose if they add a vitamin pill to their already fortified food.
There is a real perception in this country. You will talk to people and say, oh, I have a terrible diet. I just don't eat well. I don't get enough fruits and vegetables. And that is definitely true. Most of us don't eat as well as we should. But the food are fortified, and we are getting a lot more micronutrients than we think we are. And so that is the concern, that there's so much fortification of food, and then you have this other trend of people gobbling down handfuls of vitamins, and you're going to get certain groups of people that are getting too much.
You also write about the vitamin B family. Now, we want to stress that, as you write, folic acid and B12 are two vitamins that are highly recommended.
Well, they're recommended for certain populations. Right. Women of childbearing age, it's clearly been shown that folic acid will reduce the risk of having a baby with birth defects. So if you're thinking about having a baby, doctors recommend you start taking folic acid to ensure the health of that baby. Same with the elderly population. There's a certain group of people in this population that has a hard time absorbing vitamin B. And so they found that B supplements might be beneficial for the elderly people. The question is that a lot of people are taking, again, handfuls of vitamin B, you know, vitamin B, folic acid, B12, B6, to improve their heart health with the belief that it lowers something called homocysteine, which is a risk factor, believed to be a risk factor for heart problems. But recent studies have not supported that this is a useful practice and that there's really probably no benefit from taking excess vitamin B for these groups.
Tara Parker Pope, the health columnist for The Wall Street Journal, on studies showing when vitamins do more harm than good. When we come back, criticism of the studies. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, back with Tara Parker Pope, health columnist for The Wall Street Journal, talking about studies showing when vitamins do no good or more harm than good. And Tara, we've already spoken of vitamin A and B. Let's talk about C. So many people take it as a cure for the common cold, but the research has been mixed on its effectiveness and, you say, pretty disappointing overall.
Well, vitamin C is interesting because there really is some mixed data, and people are passionate about vitamin C. They really truly believe that if you take a lot of vitamin C, that you will have fewer colds and you'll feel better and more stamina. There's been some research in people in extreme situations, marathon runners, skiers, soldiers exposed to significant cold or stress. When these people took vitamin C, there was a 50% reduction in colds with vitamin C use. But these were extreme circumstances, and they don't really translate to the general population. And we have not really seen a lot of evidence, other than anecdotal evidence, that large doses of vitamin C helps prevent colds.
Well, now, and we should say, you say extreme. They're not just extreme, but they're healthy people.
Again, they are healthy people. And this really is the very interesting and exciting question that has emerged from this recent vitamin research. I mean, we've seen evidence that unhealthy people, people at risk for lung cancer, aren't helped by beta-carotene. People at risk for heart problems aren't helped by vitamin E. But we are now thinking maybe the healthy population are the people who can most benefit from this. But, you know, we have some real questions about cancer and vitamin C. A doctor pointed out to me that tumor cells like vitamin C just as much as healthy cells.
You write that research shows that cancer cells gobble up vitamin C faster than normal cells, and so the C in a person with a cancer cell might actually be promoting the cell and maybe even making the cell resistant to chemo after eating vitamin C?
It's a frightening possibility, but we have seen studies showing where antioxidant vitamins do appear to interfere with cancer treatment. There was an important study of head and neck cancer patients who were taking vitamin E in the belief that it would lower side effects from radiation. And in fact, it did lower side effects from radiation, and that was a great thing. But the patients who were taking vitamin E also had a much higher risk of having the cancer come back. And the thinking was that the reason vitamin E might have helped reduce symptoms is because it was interfering with the treatment in the first place, and that's why those people had a higher incidence. And again, you know, we've seen there was a Copenhagen study where researchers reviewed 7 randomized trials of beta-carotene, selenium, vitamins A, C, and E in several cancers, esophageal, gastric, colorectal, pancreatic, and liver cancer, to see if there was an overall benefit from antioxidant use. Mm. And the antioxidant users actually had a 6% higher death rate than the placebo users. So there's a lot of questions about whether vitamins are perhaps harmful when it comes to cancer patients.
Tara Parker Pope of the Wall Street Journal, a lot of questions, period, that you're raising. You mentioned vitamin E quickly in passing, and I just want to point out that you cite a study that showed that those people who take vitamin E showed higher rates of congestive heart failure. And the University of California, Berkeley, which discovered the vitamin in 1922, is now retracting its support?
Well, I think they're saying there's no real evidence of benefit from vitamin E. It's important to know that the people in the study that had the higher rates of congestive heart failure were already very sick. And so, again, it really speaks to this issue that in populations that are already unhealthy, vitamins probably don't benefit them and they may cause harm. It is some evidence that healthy people who take vitamins vitamin E may actually get some heart benefit, but it's really unclear.
Right. Well, Tara, let's just hear a little more of the criticism. You just mentioned one, that the people in these studies usually are already sick. Other criticism that we see on, for instance, the Life Extension Foundation website, people who really believe in vitamins and supplements, that in many of these studies, vitamins aren't combined with other nutrients that help them work better, magnesium, for instance, that in many of the studies, the doctors are aligned with drug companies. So what's your overall on this?
Well, I think that much of this research has come out of the National Institutes of Health. The doctors going into this science went into this truly believing that there would be a benefit. So if we were going to see a bias, I think that there was really optimism and hope that these studies would show dramatic benefits of vitamin use to these patient populations. You know, we do have inconsistent results. I think the message here is that we don't know the answers. We have this strong, powerful belief system that vitamins are harmless and that they're good for you, and these are not benign compounds. And I think that's what's so frightening today. The point is that we've seen a lot of evidence from clinical research showing that high consumption of, you know, antioxidants from foods is very beneficial. People who have diets high in leafy green vegetables and fruits do seem to have better health. But what we're doing in the vitamin industry is we are isolating these compounds. We're taking compounds, you know, away from the way they appear in nature. It's different than if you eat a carrot or you have a piece of fish or, you know, you eat a spinach salad where you're getting a really complex combination of these micronutrients which seem to interact and work together. When we take vitamin E, we're taking, you know, sort of a really small slice of vitamin E, a really narrow part of it. It just doesn't appear that way in nature, the way we ingest it in a vitamin pill. So I think the criticism that we aren't combining these things is fair, but we don't have the answers. I think the only answer we really have is that when you consume a diet high in these micronutrients, you will be healthier. But when you consume handfuls of pills, there's really not a lot of evidence that you'll be healthier, and you might actually be doing some harm.
Another bottom line you come up with is a reminder that a vitamin is not a drug, and if it does have an effect, it's going to be more nuanced anyway.
well, these aren't drugs. And I think the feeling is that that's a good thing, and that's why people believe in them so powerfully. But they aren't benign compounds either. And I think that's why we have to be careful. And we also have to get away from this idea that health comes in a pill bottle. It doesn't. And there's so much evidence that the answer is really quite easy. Eat right and exercise, and all these health worries start to disappear. If you just try to do a quick fix from a vitamin, it's just not going to happen.
Tara Parker Pope, health columnist for The Wall Street Journal, on recent studies showing that vitamins may not help you and may harm you. And as we said, a lot of controversy around this. Tara, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
And this quick note for you, tomorrow on Here and Now, The Art of Justice, looking at 30 years of infamous trials from the point of view of the courtroom sketch artist. What's it like when the family asks you to draw the defendant more sympathetically? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The new Hamas-led Palestinian government held its first full cabinet meeting today and faced a bitter reality. They're broke. The budget crisis comes in large part because Israel has stopped transferring $50 million a month in tax receipts to the Palestinian Authority. The U.S. and other Western governments have also threatened to cut $1 billion a year in aid to the Palestinians as long as Hamas continues to call for Israel's destruction. Well, the rift has further split the U.S. and Palestinians. So why would any want to come here? To a Jewish-sponsored school, no less. Well, a unique partnership between Al-Quds University in the West Bank and Brandeis University here in the Boston area does just that. Today, we're joined by two Palestinian graduate students visiting Brandeis. Eliana Zaidan, welcome.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Dalia Labadi.
Hi.
Just give me some of your observations about America. You'd been here twice before, you said, Eliana, to Phoenix and to Florida, your first time to New England. And, Dalia, this is your first trip to the U.S. Just some things that struck you that you've seen or...
For example, here at Brandeis, when we came, everyone was welcoming us. You know, really, people are so nice. Everyone is helping, offering help at the library, everywhere. You know, we felt at home.
I thought, well, we're Palestinians, and everyone's going to think, oh, these terrorists are coming to our land. But it was totally different than I thought. And I was really kind of shocked by the way Americans live, and I kind of felt I loved their comfortable life. I loved their...
What do you mean by comfortable?
Because life is easier here.
Easier here.
Much easier.
They don't worry about other things. They just let things go the way it goes with the flow. And that's something I really liked.
And help us again with one of, you know, with our perceptions of Palestinians, because there are people who perceive it's a very small area, so that everyone there must have seen violence. Everyone there must know someone. Do you have you both seen some of this violence we hear about?
Well, I'm a girl from Jenin, and I don't know if everybody knows. We just suffered a massacre in Jenin and thing. And I really, after those days, I kind of felt in a shock.
This is when the Israeli bulldozers came into Jenin.
Yeah, and it's not the point. It's not about how many people got killed. It's about...
Because Israel would say it wasn't a massacre and there weren't the numbers of people killed.
Yeah, my point is it's not about how many people got killed. It's about other people who are still living and the way they're living and what they're suffering right now. Because a lot of people just feel that their dignity is lost. So why are we living? We're totally humiliated and insulted. And why can we live if we have nothing to live for? So these are things that made me kind of search for answers for kind of whole two months. And that's why right now I'm one of the Palestinian students who really seek for peace with the Israeli government.
Is that what you mean, too, about the comfort? Because, you know, we certainly have violence here in the U.S., but most people feel pretty secure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we lack. And that's what we hope that our new government would bring for us. We really need secure.
But Palestinians elected the hardline militant group Hamas to lead them. This is a group Israel can't negotiate with. So how did that election make you more secure?
Look, as what came out of the elections, it's what the people wanted to vote to. It's something democratic. So democracy is about to choose your leader. So it was free and fair elections. This is what they wanted, and we'll see.
Since that's the people's decision, I think other countries, whether it was Israel or any country in the whole world, should respect it, because that's the Palestinians' decision.
But if how can you negotiate with a group that doesn't think you have the right to exist?
Both parties should communicate and come to such agreements. At the end, they should have some communication to deal with issues.
Dalia, you're studying anti-Arab sentiment in America post 9/11. We understand.
That's my thesis, yes.
That's your thesis. And what are you finding?
Well, before I came here, I believed that there is a huge anti-Arab sentiment in America. But after I came here, I kind of find that this is not true. Probably it was just at the period of September 11, and after that, just people kind of discovered the difference between terrorists and Arabs. So
we remember, too. I mean, you're reminding me, actually, that right after 9/11, there were video images that came to the U.S. of Palestinians dancing in the street and celebrating in the street after 9/11. You're shaking your head no, Dalia.
Nah, I'm sure that this couldn't happen. We won't be happy because other human beings are getting killed in other cities in the world, whether it's in the States or if it's in China. We wouldn't just be happy for that.
But it did happen. I mean,
media is a very wide technological thing that I don't really trust that much. But sometimes they just fix things together. I just don't believe whatever I see in the media.
What would you like Americans to know about your life, being a Palestinian living in the West Bank? What would you want them to know, Eliana?
There are many difficulties. For example, reaching your study, you face too much in the street, checkpoints, everything. It's difficult. It's not as easy as here. For example, being a student in Brandeis, also you have access to library, to access to much material to do your research work. So we are trying here to develop our papers as much as we can, because there we don't have such a big library and access to research material. You know how it is.
Mm. You, Dalia, what would you want people to know?
Well, Arabs are not the way that people used to think before. And there's this image about Islam and Arabs, that being terrorists and seeking the end of other people's life. And this is not true. And as
but it's true of, I mean, it's, the complicating thing is it's true of some, because we see people put on suicide belts and...
Yeah, this is something that's as a other
it's conversation. It's not the majority of people are just human.
This
beings,
is not
okay?
Islam.
We are all the children of God, We are all people. No one likes to see the suffering of other people,
Do you find, are students at Brandeis asking you about this? Do you find you get asked about this?
Yes. We were in several classes and we were asked. They saw us. Some of them maybe thought that people over there aren't dressed like we are or anything. I don't know.
Looking at you, you have beautiful modern dress. You've got your blue jeans on and, both of you look terrific. So they think that you're dressing like this here, but they don't dress like it that
there.
That's what they asked us. For example, because I'm a Muslim, someone asked me, do you put a scarf on your hair while you're over there and you just take it off here? And I'm like, no, why should I do that? And he's like, because you're religious and you're Muslims and stuff. I'm like, no, I got the right to live the way and to dress the way that I feel I'm comfortable with.
Don't you worry that with Hamas taking power that you might lose that right? You're shaking your head.
No, because Hamas, when it entered the elections, it didn't enter in a way that we want to change the way you're living. It entered that we want to change the political things.
The corruption. It was one
corruption
of the issues.
Corruption in our authority. That's what they entered. That's the intention for them. But I don't think, because if they're going to interfere in every single person's life, they're going to just collapse and it's not going to work with them.
So you're hopeful.
I got faith. That's what I got. So
how about you, Eliana?
Inshallah, we'll see. Someone has to have hope at the end for the good of all parties, I think.
Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Eliana Zaidan and Dalia Labadi, guests of Brandeis University here in the Boston area, and also pursuing master's degrees in American studies at Al-Quds University in the West Bank. Stay with us. More ahead here now. after months of speculation, we can finally all get back to work because Katie Couric has decided where she is going to work. She announced today that she will be leaving NBC's Today Show to join CBS as the first woman ever to solo anchor an evening newscast. She broke the news this morning on the 15th anniversary of her first day on the job at Today.
After listening to my heart and my gut, two things that have served me pretty well in the past, I've decided I'll be leaving Today at the end of May.
49-year-old Katie Couric helped propel the Today Show to unprecedented success. Today has won its time slot every week for the past 10 years, and it is NBC's biggest moneymaker, pulling in $500 million a year in ad sales. Well, joining us now with more on today's news is media critic for The Washington Post, Tom Shales. Tom, your first thoughts on hearing the announcement today?
Well, thank God Almighty, free at last, because the story has been hanging around so long. It just had to be announced eventually, or people in the media, at least, were going to burst. Now we can all get on with our lives, as you said.
And you can get on with, you know, looking at what this means. I mean, Katie Couric taking over for Bob Schieffer. He'd been the temporary anchor of the CBS Evening News since Dan Rather left.
Right.
CBS trailing the other two networks' newscasts. Do you think this move will make a big difference in the network nightly newscasts?
Well, with all respect to Katie Couric, who I nominated for a Peabody Award back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And the other judges laughed at me, by the way.
Yeah, let's stay with that for a second, because in full disclosure, I worked at NBC at the Today Show. You know, I had a little hard time here sort of arguing Katie's incredible interviewing skills and hard news interviewing skills. Is that what you're referring to? That, you know,
Yeah, they didn't want to take her seriously. And I had seen a great deal of very respectable, serious work. And I guess they had just seen her clowning around with Matt Lauer or something. But I thought she demonstrated tremendous versatility and great dedication to her job and a real feeling for communicating through television. The sort of thing that goes back to Dave Garraway, where it's almost instinctual. It's the ability to talk into that camera as naturally as if you're talking to your next-door neighbor. Nevertheless, I think it's bad for the evening news, for news in general, because Les Moonves, the head of CBS, has let it be known that he wants to change that newscast, and I think he wants to turn it into the Today Show in miniature and do more interviews, more light news, more happy news. He thinks it's stuffy, probably. He probably thinks the New York Times is stuffy.
Well, and so this might be a bad thing for news in general, maybe a good thing for CBS if it attracts viewers, but maybe also a bad thing for Katie, given that one of the things she's been saying off the record is that she'd like to have a more substantial role.
Yes, and I'm being pessimistic. It could be that this won't evolve at all. But I have a horrible feeling, not because Katie's a woman, not because of the Today Show or any of that, just because of the involvement of Les Moonves and all the fuss about Katie, that that this will lead to a lightening of the newscast, and then the other networks will follow suit, because they always do. It'll turn out to be that the network news will be as frivolous and silly as the local newscasts sometimes are.
Well, there was some frivolity this morning, though, that was much appreciated on the Today Show, because it was a very heartfelt, tough moment. But we want to play another piece for our listeners where Katie was speaking about her relationship with Matt Lauer, and as you'll hear, they weren't going to take themselves too seriously. Let's listen.
Once in a while, we get on each other's nerves. Well, he gets on my nerves. But I could not have asked for a more talented partner or better
Thanks.
Friend. And just as Dorothy said to the Scarecrow, I think I'm going to miss him most of all. It's not goodbye, at least not yet, but a heartfelt thank you for 15 great years.
Also coming up in this half hour.
I mean, Tom Shales, that's the kind of thing you want to hear at 7:30 in the morning, but not maybe 7:30 at night.
Right. It's personality television, and these people are our friends, and we cozy up to them, and it's a very delicate hour, 7:30 in the morning. Now, when the evening news comes around, the tone changes, or should, always has. Is it going to change now? Will there be a cast of characters rather than a list of correspondents? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Will it be Katie and Friends, a kind of Jack Benny show where she visits with her pals each night? I'm speculating on what the worst could be and hoping that none of this comes true.
Tom Shales, media critic for The Washington Post. Tom, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with this update on some of the news we're following. The son of former Liberian President Charles Taylor is being held on U.S. passport fraud charges. 29-year-old Charles MacArthur Emmanuel, also known as Chucky Taylor Jr., was arrested last week after arriving at Miami International Airport from Trinidad. Immigration officials accuse him of lying about the identity of his father on his application for a passport. Emmanuel was born in Boston. His father is facing 11 charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity for his alleged role in a civil war in neighboring Sierra Leone. Emmanuel himself was a strong man in the government of his father, providing security for his father. Eighty years ago today, journalist H.L. Mencken stood on the Boston Common, where Brahmins strolled with their parasols and made way for ducklings. In front of a huge crowd, Mencken sold a copy of his magazine, American Mercury, to the secretary of the New England Watch and Ward Society and was promptly arrested. The Society had condemned an article as obscene, but when Mencken was tried, he challenged that censorship and won the case. Marion Elizabeth Rogers is Mencken's most recent biographer. She spoke with Here Now's Bill Marks about Mencken's lifelong crusade against censorship and set the scene as a mob of students watched on that pivotal morning, April 5th, 1926.
Now, Boston had always had a long history of literary bigotry. They had censored books such as Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy and the poetry of John Dryden, including books by Hemingway. And this business of censoring books or magazines was just contrary to Mencken's point of view, because Mencken's mantra was always freedom, freedom of speech, civil liberties. And so here he was in the Boston Common, sold the copy directly to J. Franklin Chase. The students set up this huge cheer, and it made headlines across the world.
And Mencken was a bit disappointed, to a certain extent, by the public reaction to his testing of this law. I mean, at first, it seemed like a lot of major newspapers and magazines were not backing him on this.
Well, exactly right. Here he had done something that newspaper men should have been proud of, and instead people were dismissing it as a publicity stunt, which was very disappointing to Mencken. But in the end, this fight was always brought up for journalists who wanted to fight for freedom of speech.
Well, it was interesting that you began the biography with the Boston Common, the scene on the Boston Common, when you could have easily started it and probably might have maybe sold a few more copies, I don't know, with his coverage of what was one of the most famous trials of the 20s, where there was an attempt to stop teaching evolution in the schools.
Yes, some people say that if the Scopes trial had not existed, Mencken would have had to invent it, because nothing else so perfectly illustrated his conception of the typical behavior of the human animal. And the story, if your listeners are not acquainted with the story of the Scopes trial, in 1925, the House of Representatives in Tennessee had drafted a bill that made it unlawful for a teacher in any school to teach Darwin's theory of evolution, and John Scopes was a popular science teacher in the little town of Dayton, Tennessee, who was arrested for teaching the theory of evolution. And it was Clarence Darrow, the famous lawyer of his day, who elicited Mencken's help in the case to defend John Scopes. As Darrow always put it, Scopes isn't on trial, civilization is on trial. And the fundamentalist and politician William Jennings Bryan was on the side of the prosecution. It was called at that time the trial of the century. Many of America's most famous reporters were there, but it was, of course, Mencken's dispatches that attracted the most attention. They always said that Darrow's inquisition killed William Jennings Bryan, but as Mencken said, it was a job of public sanitation that Darrow never regretted. At the end of the trial, Mencken realized that this issue was going to continue on in the United States. As he always said, heave an egg out of a Pullman window and you will hit a fundamentalist almost anywhere in the United States today.
A lot of people, when they think of Mencken in the trial, they think of the play Inherit the Wind, where the reporter figure who sort of represents H.L. Mencken is seen as a sort of lowbrow or just sort of not particularly admirable cynic who believes in nothing but his own cynicism. But it seems to me that when in the biography and certainly in Mencken's attacks on fundamentalism, you see that Mencken actually did believe in something. It wasn't just simply a cynic.
Yes, yes. The character played by Gene Kelly gives Mencken really a bad name.
The law is still on the side of the lawmakers, and everything revolves around their terra firma.
Then why bother you and your newspaper?
Because I know that the sunrise is an optical illusion. My teacher told me so.
You don't seem like the kind of person who'd want to bother. You seem so...
cynical. True. True, that's part of my fascination. I do hateful things for which people love me, and I do lovable things for which they hate me. I'm admired for my detestability. Now, don't worry, little Eva. I may be rancid butter, but I'm on your side of the bread.
What I've tried to do in this biography is put Mencken in the context of his times when he was actually a very exciting and new phenomena that had come into the American scene. He inspired courage in others.
But you also have to deal with the latter part of Mencken's career. His popularity took a downward turn. He, in the 30s, he disliked FDR intensely. And because of his allegiance or love for Germany, he was slow to recognize what was happening to the Jews. And also there have been questions raised about his racial attitudes.
Yes, the contradictions in Mencken are many. Here he writes racially charged language in his diary, and yet here's a man who wrote against lynching as early as 1917 and wrote against it again in the 1930s when there was a horrific lynching on Baltimore's eastern shore. And the other contradiction is here's Mencken saying awful epithets about Jews, and yet who was a person who said, open the gates to the Jewish refugees, when Walter Lippmann, by the way, was writing in Time magazine, let's let all the Jewish refugees go to Africa, and who privately was sponsoring Jewish families to come into the United States. So this is what makes Mencken such a hard person to put a peg on.
A lot of people talk about, if only Mencken were here, we need Mencken, where is he? Would Mencken be able to work in the media today?
Mencken was always a print man. He always said that television was a pander to imbecility and that it would become a curse for newspapers, which in the end it has, I suppose. And I actually wonder if anyone would dare print Mencken today. Mencken was an isolationist. He wrote against the United States getting involved in wars. He had the courage to speak out against politicians about just about anybody. And I just wonder if anyone would dare print him today.
Marian Elizabeth Rogers is author of Mencken, The American Iconoclast. She spoke with Here Now's Bill Marks. Mencken's work continues to provoke and influence artists, including composer Mark Harvey. We'll leave you with Flat Earth Boogie from the Boo Boise Suite, a musical satire inspired by the writings of H.L. Mencken, performed here by the Aardvark Jazz Orchestra live at MIT. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.